listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, policy, and science, and advocacy. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between everything that connects to our health, well-being, and survival that comes to us from all our connections to the resources we need for life and everything that's going on in our communities, society, and planet Earth. On the show, which has been ongoing since 2010, I talk every week to different thought leaders, authors, activists, journalists, even poets, filmmakers, all kinds of different people, each of whom has a special insight and knowledge of different areas that we need to understand in order to protect and support and sustain everyone's health, the health of all people, species, beings, and biosystems here on planet Earth. So that's what we talk about every week on the show. Today's guest, I'm really thrilled to have with us again. He's a return guest, Steve Horn of the terrific website desmogblog.com. Terrific place. You can follow him and other really important reporting on that site, and he'll be talking with us today. I just want to, for a minute, just say what the kind of subtitle of Desmog Blog is. We've had Steve on before, as well as Jim Hogan, the founder of Desmog Blog, clearing the PR pollution that clouds climate science. Could anything be more relevant? Today we're going to be talking about some areas special to Steve's particular beat. He is an Indianapolis-based a research fellow for Desmog Blog and a freelance investigative journalist. He previously was a reporter and researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy, which is actually another fantastic outlet. For true investigative reporting, he is also a competitive runner and marathoner. And his writing has appeared as well as in Desmog Blog, in Al Jazeera America, The Guardian, Vice News, The Intercept, one of our favorite outlets mentioned very often, Truthout, in which I had a piece this past week, is probably still up, Alternet, another one of my outlets. So, you know, we're kind of from that world of journalism, and Steve is covering an incredibly important angle on all of the things that we talk about and cover here on Connect the Dots. And it's his second visit to us. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Steve Horn.
Good to be back on. Thanks for having me. And, yeah, the journalism has gotten a little too crazy, so I've taken a little bit of a break from competitive running. But as of last year, which that's I was a competitive runner. I haven't fully retired, but I'm just more exercising to stay in shape rather than for racing. But that's not a big deal for this show. I just thought I would start with some fun stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, also just to say, you know, like I think it's really, I mean, just to, you know, as a sideline to what we're going to be talking about, which is some, you know, heavy duty information really that's actually happening that we kind of really need to know about. But also, we as reporters, any journalist is really on the front line of looking at what's going on, and especially a deep dish journalist like yourself, who, you know, kind of delves into areas that are unknown or disputed or not yet validated and proven, and is finding out stuff that we need to know but that many people don't want to know or have it, you know, don't want to believe. And so, you know, being in the front line of looking at that, which is part of the job, it's also great to have other things that help one stay happy and maintain sanity, because we're kind of the front
Absolutely.
Line. By the time somebody is like saying, you know, oh, did you see the whatever, you know, if it's in the area of our beat, we've seen it, we've been caring and knowing about it for weeks, months, or years. So, you know, that's just the way it is. And I have a particular liking and affection for Steve Horn's beat and work, because he really looks into all of the things that are going on around energy, fracking, drilling, pipelines, and has been for years. Doesn't really, it's not like, you know, you just kind of came along yesterday and realized this is an issue. because it showed up in your community, or although that may have happened at one time, this is like your specific beat, and it really, and it's actually, you know, very interrelated with mine, and it really turns out to be a very important beat, both for climate and also for where democracy is going in America and whose side various sort of sectors of our society are on in terms of protecting living being systems and the planet itself. So from that, what we're going to be doing on today's show is a kind of retrospective of Steve's work over, you know, a number of recent years. And you know, that I think that's going to, you know, one of the things that happens with the news is that things come at us. You know, what's happening today? What's happening today? What did Trump say? What new thing was discovered? You know, we're always looking at this constant barrage in the time that we're living in, you know, of developments. And this area is so important that I think it really merits a retrospective where we look back at what we've learned and what we've known, what we now know, over, you know, a year and a half or so, year plus, of covering, at, you know, a specific issue, which is the signature issue. And we're talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline, the, you know, which was the occasion for the Standing Rock Water Protector Uprising, and, you know, really looking at what we've learned and, you know, through your reporting over the last year, and kind of look back and integrate maybe some of that knowledge and share that with people who are, you know, already following it and people who may be new to it. So that's what we're going to be doing on today's show. I would like to begin with, Steve, with an article that you did a year ago, September. And I'll just read the title, and then we can sort of discuss both what you were reporting on and what the implications of that are. The title is, and it was on DSmogBlog for anyone who wants to go and access and read it, "Weeks Before Dakota Access Pipeline Protests Intensified, Big Oil Pushed for Expedited Permitting."
Yeah, well, okay, so, you know, just the brief overview of that article and sort of looking further back just to sort of outline our coverage of Dakota Access, and I would guess I would say mostly mine. If you look at the portal we have set for that, there's been about, I just counted, about 45 articles written since early 2015, actually. So it was even before Standing Rock, I was covering this pipeline because I saw that it was a key piece of infrastructure for moving this oil obtained from fracking in the Bakken Shale to the Gulf Coast that the industry had wanted for a long time. They originally were pushing to have an on-ramp on the Keystone XL that would be 100,000 barrels per day of this Bakken oil included with the tar sands oil. Keystone XL never went through. It was eventually nixed by the Obama administration in November of 2015. So this pipeline became even more important for the industry. Otherwise, they were relying entirely on oil by rail, and it was very difficult for them to get oil from the north part of the United States to the Gulf Coast refineries. That's why we picked this pipeline as something that we saw was important. It was just mostly from a market perspective, looking at how the industry thinks about these issues. And so that's, you know, we began covering it even really, you know, right when the presidential campaigns were firing up in early 2016. That said, that particular article that you're pointing to points to a broader trend, actually, that had taken place, several times over during the Obama administration, where this permit called the Nationwide Permit 12, which is handed out by the Army Corps of Engineers, it has been given to several companies, including Energy Transfer Partners for Dakota Access, to cross Lake Oahe, which eventually sparked the Standing Rock protests, the occupation, encampment, et cetera. But this permit had been used several times over. It was used for the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is now called the Gulf Coast Pipeline, which runs from Oklahoma down to the Gulf Coast down in Texas. It was used for a couple of Enbridge pipelines. And so there was legal precedent on the books. For all those projects, it went to the federal courts. And federal judges said that it was legal to use this nationwide Permit 12. What environmental groups are arguing was that it was a way to expedite and fast-track permitting without public review, because with a nationwide Permit 12, you don't have to do public hearings. There is no public commenting period. And basically, it's an under-the-radar way to approve pipelines, and it's been used. And they can be used. They're usually used in a way where it's a, it's supposed to be for a half an acre in size or smaller patch where an infrastructure project needs to be permitted by the Army Corps of Engineers. What they've been doing, what they were doing for other pipelines, was calling large pipelines, thousands of half an acre size projects, kind of coupling them together and giving them, scores of these nationwide Permit 12 permits as a way to avoid public transparency, public hearings, public commenting, et cetera. So, this is something that became kind of normalized to the legal system. It was something that came to a head with Dakota Access. And that's sort of actually a really important background to how these protests started. It was, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe was saying, well, like, you guys never did a complete consultation with us. It was not a thorough review. And that was by design, really. This is something that happened several times with other tar sands pipelines, and I would say it finally erupted with this Dakota Access Pipeline, but it wasn't the first time it was challenged. I just think that in the case of this particular pipeline, tensions arose, and it all came to a head. It's just the perfect storm, if you will, which gave rise to what became the encampment at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, Cannonball, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is it's so incredible that they would take, this permit for, a less than an acre and then just get a whole bunch of them, like they're, potato chips or something, and just line them all up and then take over a huge swath of land. And so, this is one of the points that I make over and over when we're discussing these issues on Connect the Dots and in my other reporting, which is, for the communities involved, it's like that one, mile or those several acres, whatever it is, this is like suddenly hitting our community. Our community is uprising. Our community is, we're trying to organize, because we suddenly found out without announcement or without environmental review that this is happening, that will terribly, that will impact our community. But meanwhile, it's community by community by community by community. This is why, these are pipelines. So all the, wherever the drilling or the extraction is occurring is one very afflicted location. Wherever the pipelines are going through and taking right of way and risking pollution and damage to different communities and properties, that's the problem. Wherever there's export activities, where it's being shipped out to where it's being sold abroad, or wherever it's being processed, refined, used in power. So, when you add all of these different things up, it's many, many, many communities being affected. And so the whole notion of this, low-grade extractive gas and oil, or natural gas, which is where I came in reporting on fracking, is like a bridge fuel. As if, we just drill in one spot and this is going to tide us over for a little while. In fact, it's a massive investment in infrastructure that is affecting both climate and multiple communities all across the United States and huge acreage of the United States. So, this permit that is really serving the building out of a mass infrastructure is being done by design out of public view with these tiny little permits, stacking up.
Right.
It doesn't show and transparency or good faith.
Yeah, and like you said, these do have, there are ecological impacts that can and will take place along these pipelines, whether it's Dakota Access, whether it's Enbridge's system, which benefited from the nationwide Permit 12, that basically I've called the Keystone XL clone system, or whether it's TransCanada's southern leg of the Keystone XL. I call it the Keystone XL clone because it was designed and does the same thing as Keystone XL is designed to do, that is carry tar sands from Alberta down to the Gulf Coast refineries. What Enbridge did was use, probably wisely use this nationwide Permit 12 system to break its pipelines into several different pieces, call them different names, never have, you know, one gigantic name like Keystone XL, but they all connect and go down to the same area where Keystone XL goes. So I have, you know, done a whole series on the Keystone XL clone pipeline. One of, you know, one of the prongs of that series is looking into this nationwide Permit 12 process. But the reason why the nationwide Permit 12 process is also important is that it basically usurps the conventional environmental impact statement process, where the government has to, you know, the EPA and other agencies that are involved in the permitting process, Department of Interior sometimes, et cetera. These agencies often have to get together and write up a environmental impact statement that's a lengthy document that outlines all of the various potential impacts environmentally that these pipeline projects or other infrastructure projects could have on, you know, landowners on U.S. land. What this Nationwide Permit 12 process does is the opposite. It's usually a 3-4 page document, very vague, you know, obviously far less specific than a, you know, multi-100 page document. And again, that's part of the process. It you know, there's far less scrutiny than given. It's a document that is, again, much more vague, and it takes citizens basically out of the process. The whole reason behind the environmental impact statement process was to get citizens more involved in the process as part of a broader process called the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. And so what all these lawsuits that I wrote about, the challenges Nationwide Permit 12 centered around, was that this was a violation of NEPA. And basically what happened under the Obama administration really was the normalization of the gutting of NEPA, that is the normalization of, you know, getting around citizen involvement and having their voices heard on these pipeline projects, which again came to a head with the Standing Rock uprising, if you want to call it that, the water protectors, et cetera. That was sort of seen as the last straw for especially indigenous peoples. This had happened so many times, it finally came to a head in 2016, and that's what gave rise to this movement.
Mm-hmm. Let's just take a brief angle down a different question, and then we'll come back to more of your articles and more of these topics. But, you know, right now there are several outstanding lawsuits, and precisely the claim has been that, you know, without a proper environmental assessment, you know, this places an undue burden. It harms, you know, the tribe. It breaks tribal treaties. It harms individuals and their right to food, livelihood, and clean water. And, you know, right now there are several lawsuits in process that have, you know, are progressing with making these claims. How does the whole thing stand legally if there is this kind of, you know, permit, if there has been a normalization of ignoring or failing to do environmental studies, and if we now have a Trump administration who's wanting to tear down, environmental protections and the EPA itself. This, I think, can be seen as a downward process that did not begin with Trump, but it may indeed be even further worsened by, his administration. Just your thoughts and comments on that.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a broader history, and we won't have to go into the whole thing, but there was an earlier push even in, so we're talking about an evolution of where, how did this come to be and what's next. So the beginning of the curtailing of the National Environmental Policy Act and citizen involvement in these sorts of permitting decisions actually began, that I've seen, really, I mean, some could say during the Reagan era, but there was another program during the Clinton administration, actually by a man that's now seen as a champion of green causes, Al Gore. He ran it. It was called the Reinventing Government Initiative, RIGO, basically looking into ways where permitting could be expedited and where things could happen more quickly. And so I think that from there, maybe even before that, during the Reagan era, there's been a slow but steady evolution of the curtailing of NEPA. And so we discussed the Obama administration's role with these nationwide permit 12s. And fast forwarding now to today, under the Trump administration, it is obviously abundantly clear that the Trump administration is completely anti-environmental, completely against acting on climate change, pulled our country out of the Paris Climate Agreement, has yet to really face a big pipeline decision, a brand new one, but in its first days in office did green light the Keystone XL pipeline, and in its first days in office did give an executive order to continue building the Dakota Access pipeline. But I think that the Dakota Access is already kind of moving along, was already stuck in courts, but in terms of these sorts of non-citizen involvement and expediting pipeline permitting or expediting export terminals, particularly right now, that's something we're going to see happening. And there's a big push right now in Congress, for example, on the export terminals, to do that more quickly. I think that this is obviously not, under the Trump administration and with the Republicans in charge right now in both the House and the Senate, we're going to see this sort of push happen increasingly more vigorously. And it's already been tucked into a more broad energy bill that's been proposed. It's moving along in the Senate right now at the federal level. So I don't expect this trend to go backwards at all. I expect it to continue moving forwards, unless citizens challenge it and there's movements to stop it. The people in power right now are definitely in favor of this trend.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned the Paris climate talks, recently the president has withdrawn the U.S. and other officials, mayors, other governors are, saying no, we'll voluntarily participate. So, we already have the kind of drama going on about his withdrawal. Going back to December of 2015, you actually have a very interesting piece and I'll read the title and then we can discuss it, which I think may surprise many environmentally aware or somewhat aware people, because it sort of alters our picture of, who is a climate champion, really looking at that seriously and in depth is really important, because it's going to take more than just going, climate, I love it. I believe in global warming. It's going to take more than that to really, these public espousals with other things going on, in policy that we don't all track and pay attention to as closely as you are doing on our behalf. But, this particular article is titled, "During Paris Climate Summit, Obama signed Exxon Coke-backed bill expediting pipeline permits." How does that relate to what we've been discussing? That seems confusing.
Well, as a general principle, whether it was during Paris or any time during his administration, as an initiative led by his top climate energy czar, as she was called, Heather Zeichel, was part of a liaison team that often met with the industry, the American Petroleum Institute, and others, and was part of it, something that was meant to expedite pipelines. So, this was something that was kind of reported in the energy press in places like Energy Wire, and he, for example, in 2012 when he was running for re-election, then President Obama went to Cushing, Oklahoma, and signed an executive order to expedite permitting for pipelines and other related infrastructure. And also at that same, when he signed that, he was in Cushing, Oklahoma. He was standing in front of the pipes that would become the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. He also signed an executive order to permit that particular pipeline. It's now called the Gulf Coast Pipeline. So, I think it was a way for him in 2012 to kind of cozy up with potential industry donors, or to at least posture as if he wasn't too anti energy industry to anti-oil and gas. And a lot, you know, many people in the environmental movement saw that as a big slap in the face. When I covered it, I actually thought, you know, I'm not really, I wasn't really surprised that he did that, you know, given his ardent support for fracking and for most things oil and gas already. It didn't shock me that he would go to Cushing, Oklahoma, and give a very pro-industry, very pro-pipeline speech. But many actions that followed, you know, all came in, you know, under the footsteps of that guiding executive order to expedite pipeline permits, which came in, I believe it was March 2012, which was, you know, about 6 or 7 months before he was reelected as president when he was running against Mitt Romney. So you have to look at that particular moment in March 2012. You know, we're going back 5 years, but it was a pivotal moment for the industry and for pipeline politics, for energy politics in the United States. And there's famous photos that you can see on YouTube. You can look at the speech that Obama gave in Cushing, Oklahoma, and you know, he sounds like almost like a spokesman for the oil and gas industry in that speech. And that's when, you know, going forward from there, that's when not only the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline was permitted, he set up an entire system called the, something like the performance dashboard, where you could track how quickly pipelines were being set up. That was on the Department of Transportation's website. But then from there, several Enbridge pipelines were permitted and built in existence, which I've been calling the Keystone XL clone system. That's where Dakota Access came from, and expediting the permitting of that with a nationwide permit 12. So it was really after that particular speech and that particular executive order where these nationwide permit 12s really rose as a blunt tool for the government to use to quickly and under the radar, again, permit pipelines, domestic ones in particular.
I was just asking about the inconsistency or the apparent inconsistency between, you know, yay, the Paris Agreement, this is so wonderful, we're finally doing something constructive, and simultaneously signing, you know, as detailed in your article of December 2016, you know, having the whole context of the nationwide permits that we've been discussing, and then, you know, further expediting of pipeline permits as the summit actually proceeds. I mean, this would seem to be a mixed message. You know, it's like cognitively dissonant. How would it, you know, an average, less well-informed member of the general public interpret? Hooray, we signed the climate agreement, and now we're going boo-hoo, they got out of the climate agreement, with the fact that we're expediting pipeline permits, which are going to contribute to accelerating climate change. I'd love to hear, you know, your take on how the average person or, you know, somewhat well-informed, pseudo-well-informed people should look at this.
Well, I think that the way that it should be looked at is that the Paris Climate Agreement at its core was a non-binding agreement in which the countries that agreed to it, there's no penalty that can be doled out if one doesn't meet its obligations or its set out obligations to the agreement. So, say, for example, if these pipelines that were expedited under this congressional bill that was signed by Obama in the immediate aftermath of Paris, say those pipelines and the greenhouse gases that are emitted as the life cycle result of these pipelines from digging the oil out of the ground all the way to perhaps exporting that oil to another country or that gas to another country. There's really no punishment the United States receives for being the bad guy at the United Nations and not meeting its obligations. And that's sort of the tragedy, one could say, or the farce, others could say, of the Paris climate negotiations and all these other United Nations climate negotiations is that, you know, countries from around the world, you know, fly in jets to these summits and talk a good game about what they're going to do about climate change. But the proof is in the pudding. And if you look at things like this pipeline bill and these, you know, the nationwide permit 12s and various other mechanisms through which pipelines can be permitted quickly into existence, they obviously fly in the face of something like the Paris Climate Agreement, in which The countries say they're going to do X, Y, and Z to meet 2 degree Celsius goal, which, by the way, isn't even an extremely ambitious goal to begin with. Some climate scientists actually say that 2 degrees, you know, if 2 degrees is the goal, it's already punishing much of the global south and a lot of the world into a miserable existence to begin with. So there are all kinds of problems, you know, looking, you know, kind of peeling this back with the agreement to begin with and the politics of these United Nations negotiations, which are dominated by the global powers who are the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases, countries like the United States, like China, like India, like Russia, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, the petro powers of the world, who you'll contribute the most to the climate change and are doing overall the least to actually peel back the problem. So, yeah, there's a, you know, so to me, it was almost perfectly symbolic that right after the Paris Climate Agreement, something like this would happen. It might seem contradictory to many, but to me, it wasn't actually, you know, extremely surprising. To some, it may be disappointing if they had a lot of you know, hope and faith in what came out of Paris and other United Nations climate negotiations. But to me, you always have to look at, you know, there's the rhetoric and there's these sort of, you know, the things that make people feel good. But then you really have to look at, you know, read between the lines and actually look at congressional bills, look closely at clauses, do keyword searches of things, and see what's actually in these bills. For example, the bill that we're talking about right now was a broader bill on transportation in general called the FAST Act, or the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, which had, you know, infrastructure and pipeline built within it, but you had to search for that in the bill. It's a 1,300 you know, plus page bill, 1,300 page bill. So, you know, only a small part of it dealt with pipelines. A lot of it dealt with highways and other infrastructure. But that's just the importance of always, you know, when a big bill, especially like a bill that has a lot of pages that might have old bills tucked within it, which was the case in this one, you really have to just kind of look at, you know, what might be in it, what might be hidden. And for, you know, in the case of this bill, it was on page 1,141 of the 1,300-page bill where this streamlining provision fell. So it's not like I read the whole bill, but I did use the find option that you can use on your computer to look for keywords, and this popped up.
So, you know, it's like there's a kind of, you know, like there's, it's not a food chain, but, you know, I'm just using that as an analogy. There's kind of a food chain. There is the, you know, there's the feel-good headline, you know, hooray, we signed the climate agreement, or boo, we, you know, we're withdrawing from it, but hooray, some political elected officials in the United States are vowing that they're going to do something and, you know, persist and carry on with this. Hooray. So there's that level of understanding. And on the, you know, on Facebook and social media, people are circulating these things and, you know, kind of feeling reassured by the, you know, by the statements designed to reassure. But then there's the different level of reality, which is what is actually going on in public policy. And individuals like you invest that, who report on it, put it out there. And then there's, you know, a certain class of people that will follow someone like you, will read your articles, or, you know, someone like me or whatever. You know, we're all the people that are trying to actually get at the deeper information. It isn't scintillatingly fascinating reading the way, you know, Trump's latest outrageous statement might be, or his latest tweet, or whoever he got into a feud with, or whatever, you know, that people, you know, his attention will be seized by that. But, you know, so there's a class of people who actually want to know and read the kind of investigation that you do. And then there's you and the class of people that are actually looking very deeply at what's really going on. And yet, you know, we are a democracy. Everybody has an opinion. And, you know, depending on the depth of their, you know, the depth of what they are following or learn about or know about, they could be anywhere. People share the same values, be concerned about climate. climate could be anywhere on this spectrum, and therefore really differing as to strategies and tactics for you know, bringing about aims, or for really understanding the multitude of different players from all sides of the supposed spectrum of opposition that in fact on this deeper level all be holding hands and working together against those of us who are, you know, deeply concerned about climate. I mean, do you think, would you amend my, you know, or edit my kind of general kind of summary of that? Do you think that's close to the truth, or how do you view that?
I think that's a good analysis of the landscape. I would say that there are occasions where some people, I guess, who are involved more on the green NGO side, especially if they are, you know, professionally paid to be part of green NGOs, I sometimes don't like that my work points out that, you know, just speaking from my own experiences, that, you know, for example, Obama has been doing these things and it's not quite as rosy or happy of a picture as they may be portraying. They, you know, they often want to paint it as a very simplistic narrative where Obama is trying so hard to push for climate action, but the GOP is so into climate change denial that he can't really do anything, and they were such obstructionists. That was sort of the narrative before Trump came along. Now, which obviously the landscape has changed politically, but it wasn't, you know, these articles weren't being widely promoted by groups, I won't name them, but, you know, the mainstream green groups didn't exactly promote every single one of these types of articles on their social media channels or anything. And, you know, I wasn't surprised that sometimes when I read an article where it would make, you know, maybe a Republican wouldn't look as good, those articles were much more likely to be promoted by those same groups. So that's another, you know, kind of a key part of the landscape is, you know, how do bigger, you know, green professional groups situate themselves, and, you know, what kind of content gets promoted. Obviously, they're tracking these issues probably more closely than almost anyone in society because it's their job to do so. But they also filter out information in a way that can impact how lots of people end up viewing these situations, which can then impact what people end up doing about them. So I think that that's just an additional piece of the puzzle there, something that I've dealt with a lot in my years doing this type of work. But yeah, I'd say overall, there's a pretty, besides that, I think that you did a really good job of laying out the landscape that we're dealing with for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because we also, you know, it's really, you know, if there's an environmental group, if there's a green group, you know, then they, a group, you know, could be building our trust and our belief in them for a number of years. And then if, for example, their funding picture changes and they accept donations, you know, and they're not screaming that from the rooftops, you know, they could sort of trim back their critiques or their advocacy in some particular area because of some funding support that comes in the struggle to maintain all those salaries and kind of stay alive. And, you know, we've seen the most egregious example of that undoubtedly with the Environmental, you know, Defense Fund, which has been, you know, basically for years an apologist for fracking, working with industry to sort of do studies to try to pretend that in some facet it could be made safe by patching pipelines or whatever. And, you know, the science of those studies has been actually debunked. You know, I did a whole piece on that for TrueSig. You know, so and yet right now the same group is working with, you know, in the agriculture area with, you know, well, how can we make industrial agriculture, monocrop culture, more sustainable, you know, because that's also a huge contributor to climate change, as well as being, you know, a contributor to malnutrition, toxicity because of the intensive use of chemicals. Animal rights people are rightly, you know, upset about their treatment of animals. You know, it's another huge problem in the food sector. And there they are, you know, kind of occupying that ground where they get funded and as a middleman to sort of whitewash some of these issues. But, you know, I mean, do these groups, you know, make an announcement when a funder comes in and then, you know, they kind of soft pedal some particular aspect of what they otherwise would be championing? Have you seen that?
Well, you know, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So I think another example of that, not more recently, I would say, but another one that's really popped up, you know, in the past couple weeks, again, reared its head, is the Sierra Club, only in the sense that Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York City, is a major funder of its Beyond Coal initiative, which is very well staffed, has shut down, you know, helped in the pushback to shut down a lot of coal-fired power plants around the United States, and one could say has even been somewhat instrumental, not the only piece of the puzzle, but a key piece of the puzzle in, you know, shifting the energy grid in the United States, the power grid, from being dominated by coal power to being dominated by natural gas power, which begs the question, does Michael Bloomberg have investments in natural gas, oil, fracking, et cetera? And the answer is yes. So through Bloomberg Philanthropies, which is what is funding the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal initiative, not the only funder, but the predominant and major funder of that initiative, Bloomberg Philanthropies is funding it, and that philanthropy has an investment vehicle called Willett Advisors. And Willett Advisors LLC, it's not online anymore, but it is outlined in Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, a small portion of the book, where she's talking about how billionaires can't be our saviors that we point to help change societal issues, basically. In that chapter of the book, she outlines how this Willett Advisors LLC, you know, while it's funding, or while Bloomberg Philanthropies is funding Beyond Coal, is investing in fracking. They've since taken that down from their website. There are still screenshots that exist of that. But this is just history repeating itself with the Sierra Club as an example. They have moved into another movement called Beyond Natural Gas, but it's far lesser staffed. It's far less, I would say, ardent in its arguments against natural gas as compared to coal. You know, they don't fight as hard to shut down natural gas power plants, for example. They're more pushed for reforms and for, you know, for some things in the supply chain, but it's not staffed or funded in the same way as the Beyond Coal initiative. And yeah, I think that that's just an important thing to look at, especially, you know, why is this a today thing? And that's just Naomi Klein's book that came out a few years ago. It's because Bloomberg, his philanthropy, just funded a documentary that's on, you can watch right now online, that was made in a team with National Geographic on coal. It's called From the Ashes, and it talks about all the impacts of coal, and how the Sierra Club and other organizations have been on the front lines trying to get beyond coal. But it doesn't highlight at all the impacts of natural gas or fracking or any of that. So that's just left out of the story. And so that sort of still begs more questions. What exactly is Bloomberg, or what is Bloomberg investing in fracking? What is this Willett Advisors investing in? All we know is that there was a portal on the Bloomberg.com website that said, this is a vehicle that invests in oil and gas assets that's since been taken down. But we don't know the details of what companies or how much money, but it is troubling. And it's history repeating itself because, of course, the Sierra Club was caught up in another example of this where the CEO of Chesapeake Energy, Aubrey McClendon, gave their Beyond Coal initiative $26 million to fight against coal, which in turn helped promote gas back probably when you and I started following fracking back in 2009, 2010, 2011 under Carl Pope, their former executive director, who recently, full circle, Carl Pope just co-wrote a book about going beyond coal with Bloomberg that just came out very recently. So nothing's the players have changed. Aubrey McClendon is no longer alive. He died in a car crash in 2016.
Right.
But Bloomberg has, you know, in my opinion, taken his place insofar as that story goes. And it's still something that requires more reporting and investigation, but it has been covered at least a little bit by Naomi Klein in her book.
Well, you know,
basically, you have somebody
who is a politician or a major figure of some kind, a high net worth individual, can come in and in ostensibly doing something philanthropic, you know, they can actually put their thumb on the scale and delay the more, you know, the most crucial front lines of energy development, you know, or you know, they can really influence what a major organization does, what people think, how they act, and actually, while pretending or while, you know, seeming to be a proponent of something, they have put their hand on the scale and they have delayed the more crucial front line from being funded, acted upon, or in public awareness. Because as of right now, to be hammering on coal, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like most of the plants are closed. They're going out of business. It's not that it's completely eradicated, but it's on the wane. Whereas here, with everything that we've been discussing in this show, and you know all that you've been reporting on, the gas and oil and you know that whole thing is like actually accelerating, proceeding, growing, and being built out. So instead of the resource or the advocacy being focused on that, they're fighting, you know, a rear guard action. It's like doing a big documentary on why we shouldn't wear a girdle, you know, or something. It's unhealthy at a time when they're on the wane. No one wears them.
Coal is still, you know, it's not completely out of business. I think sometimes,
right?
You know, environmental groups do overstate the case for how dead coal is. There's still quite a bit of coal being extracted, and still quite a bit of coal being placed in the power plants. But you know, to your point, I think that there's a, you know, this came back to, you know, in my mind, I want to talk about it now, Josh Fox, who made the film Gasland 1 and 2, and who's kind of been, you know, one of the faces of the anti-fracking movement over the past half decade or more. He and others just put out a press release on his documentary, which they put out on July 6th last week, which talks about the documentary and the role they think that Bloomberg is playing, as we've been discussing. So it's something that people are talking about. I haven't really seen picked up by press yet. The reason I'm talking about it is because I'm interested in pursuing it further, and I already was aware of these things. And so when I saw these things coming together, this new documentary, this new book, et cetera, I knew that, okay, maybe it's time to start moving on this and put some of the reporting more together and maybe put together a story on it. I think that it's no coincidence that Carl Pope is now working alongside Michael Bloomberg, and that I think has disappeared from the internet that showed that it was investing in oil and gas. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, maybe I have a story or someone else does some reporting on this and it's revealed that, you know, there are some, you know, not coincidences between all these forces aligning.
Well, this is a bit of conflict of interest. It's fundamentally misleading and misdirecting the target for activism and the attention of the public. Since we got on to this topic, which I wasn't expecting we would be going there in this show, but since we're here, I just have to also ask about something like Governor Jerry Brown standing up in Europe and positioning himself as a climate leader. And, you know, I think a lot of people on the liberal left spectrum, obviously not all at all, but some would be going, a Democratic governor has stood up to confront, you know, the terrible things that the current administration is doing. Yay, hooray. And yet I'm aware through, you know, our nationwide network with friends and activists all across the United States, including in the state of California, that the governor who is positioning himself as a climate champion has actually played a very pro-fossil fuel role. And, you know, it begins to make one wonder whether he wants to lead the climate parade in order to lead it and really advance it, or in order to perhaps squelch it, and protect, you know, the family investments, which are rumored to perhaps have influenced many of the positions he's taken in government office. I don't know whether you've ever looked into him, you know, or if you have any thoughts about, again, the, you know, but it's going back to a theme we've been discussing earlier in the show, which is, you know, the public presentation is one thing, and the actual policy or impact of it is something else.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, for Jerry Brown in California, as a case study, it's a perfect case study of what we're talking about, where him and his state are seen as the state level, almost caricature, if you will, or the embodiment, to put it more in a friendly way, of the resistance, to use that term, of many things that Trump is doing, including on climate, but not limited to climate, and so. Where that falls apart on climate and energy is the fact that, you know, as a recent story showed that was published by In These Times by Kate Aronoff, it's a really long story but worth reading. It shows that Jerry Brown is currently negotiating at the negotiating table for drafting a new climate policy for his state as its governor. And at the table has been the oil and gas industry. Of course, it is negotiating, so some would say, well, where's the scandal there? But they've had a very prominent role at the table and have helped to shape, through leaked documents that she obtained in her reporting. It shows that they are basically in the driving seat of these negotiations and really shaping the contours of where that policy goes. And of course, in the past several years, there's a debate of whether or not fracking will take place in a large-scale way in the Monterey Shale in California. And there's been sort of its own kind of like a mini version of, the Bernie Sanders movement versus the Hillary Clinton camp, sort of looking into whether or not fracking should be banned versus whether fracking should be well regulated. That was a debate that's taken place over the past several years. I know that Brown was on the side of, we have to be real. We have to be real here. Oil and gas drilling will take place. It needs to be regulated to protect citizens because we're not going to, take it away. So, and of course, that was the same exact argument that for a long time Governor Cuomo was making in New York before the citizens of New York successfully pushed for a ban of fracking in the state of New York. So, in a way,
and that was the Clinton energy policy as well. That was also the Clinton energy policy.
Yeah, and that was.
Is there any place where this has happened, where there has been effective regulation of fracking?
Some would say. I think even the Clinton camp would have said, no, not yet. But we'll do it the right way. And the reason why we haven't been able to do it the right way is because of, they point to the 2005 Energy Policy Act. And so, as you're probably aware, and many listeners are aware, that's what took place at the Democratic National Convention. There was a big debate over the language that should be in the Democratic Party platform over fracking, whether or not it should be a ban or whether or not it should be regulations. And then, of course, Clinton, during the debates against Sanders, she said, well, by the time I'm done and there's all these different regulations and different tests that we do, fracking will pretty much be banned. So according to them, they'll regulate it so heavily that there won't be much fracking. But, that's, of course, all rhetoric. The reality is that just really hasn't taken place yet, and it's not clear whether or not they would actually act upon these very strict regulations that they say they're going to put forward. Of course, Pennsylvania is a state that has a Democratic Party governor, Tom Wolf, and not much has changed, even though he talked a good game about regulating fracking and all the protections and safeguards he would put in place. So if you want to see a decent case study of, fracking still continuing apace under a Democratic Party governor, first look at who brought it into the state. That would be Governor Ed Rendell. And then look at, now who's the governor now, which is Tom Wolf. So all kinds of examples.
Well, when I drilled into
really
the energy policy out of the platform, and I did a piece on Truthdig about that, what their claim was that they could patch all the pipelines and therefore reduce the methane emissions. That was one of their claims, that, you know, better detection of and repair of pipelines would make a huge difference. And, of course, they based that plan on research from, recycling back to an earlier topic on the show, the Environmental Defense Fund, which has spent, received millions of dollars of industry money to develop that kind of plan, and were making claims that it would be effective, and the science of it was debunked. And so that was actually subject of a piece that I did for Truthdig. It basically, all the money and all the attempts to kind of put lipstick on the pig, and patch all these leaks is simply impractical, and the methods that they were recommending were, it's questionable science, because they claimed it was possible, and that was debunked, and there were errors and, bad numbers used and all of that. So here we circle around again.
These EDF studies that you're referring to, which was, a dozen different studies on aspects of the supply chain for natural gas and fracking, and all the way to exporting pipelines and all the other infrastructure that's involved in bringing that product to market. Those studies were also funded, again, by Michael Bloomberg. Not only, but he was a key funder of those. It's widely touted on the EDF website, on the Bloomberg Philanthropies website. So, I would say, this is another piece of the puzzle of the things that Bloomberg was doing to push for getting off of coal and power plants, and kind of normalizing or greenwashing fracking in various ways, or sometimes by not talking about it, by only talking about coal, sometimes by, when you talk about it, talk about doing it safely and responsibly, which is, of course, a favorite thing that a lot of Democratic Party politicians like to talk about, and now Bloomberg, some environmental groups. I think this is all a piece of the same puzzle, and the key question for looking into this as a sort of reporting matter or investigative matter is, how much money indeed does Bloomberg have invested in various oil and gas companies through his philanthropy through that investment vehicle called Willett Advice? I think that's a question that really needs to be explored and answered to really understand what has taken place over the past 5 years or so since he really got involved in this Beyond Coal movement and funding it.
And, of course, he also himself has a media outlet. Even through his own outlet, he has, he's multiple tentacles reaching in various directions that are actually counterproductive if we seek to address the climate problem. I hope that you do wind up doing this article and connect all these dots for our listeners. I very much look forward to reading it one day, and we're coming to the end of our time. I think there were other things we wanted to cover, but I think it's turned out to be quite an interesting show in terms of, media literacy and understanding of the different levels at which we have to look at, the rhetoric versus what's actually happening. And that's really important to know and understand in order to take a strategic direction that really leads somewhere. So I'm really grateful for all your work, Steve Horn on DeSmog Blog. Listeners, please go there, check him out. Steve is very prolific in his articles. I can understand why you're not doing competitive running, because this takes a lot of work to do what you're doing.
It does.
Yeah, it really does. And your, command of the subject is impressive and wonderful. It's great having you on the show. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with our listeners here in Connect the Dots.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have you back again, because it's a moving train that we're all on, for sure. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. Make sure to go to the Smog Blog. You can actually support it. There's a nice sticker on the front page called Support Independent Journalism. We have to support the Deep Dish work that is being done rather than getting lost in the flurry of superficial information. I also want to point out that Steve has a blog up, that, you know, a recent blog up from the last week that we were going to discuss and get to today. Go to the website, read it, see the quality we're talking about, and I think it'll interest anyone who's been following the Dakota Access Pipeline and Standing Rock. The article is called Dakota Access Security Firm's Top Advisor Led Military Intelligence Efforts for 1992 LA Riots. This is, I think, is really important to understand. Not only does other media fail to cover some of these events and protests and things that are going on, but actually behind the scenes, there's collusion going on in the use of military force against American citizens. That's a whole other topic. We could probably do a whole show on that. Anyway, thanks, Steve. It's been great to have you. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose-Levy.